talking to me?
Funny, like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead, make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Good morning. It is July 25th. I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Batts.
And Sam Maroney.
Sam Maroney is here today. Hello, Sam. Thanks for joining us.
We're having Sam Maroney.
You've heard that before, I'll bet.
Several hundred times.
Oh, okay.
Sam is a local guy, good buddy of mine, and a movie entertainment journalist and a movie buff, and he has a book that he wrote a year or two ago called Sam Maroney Tripping Through Pop Culture, The Misadventures of an Entertainment Writer, and he's going to talk about this movie, and he's going to talk about his life.
It's been made into a movie? Oh, boy! Is Brad Pitt playing you?
His book.
Oh, his book. Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
Yeah. So, Sam, you're an old movie buff, aren't you?
I am.
And I'm not saying you're old. I'm just saying, but you like old movies.
I do.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
We were just talking, you don't see a whole lot of new movies, and in some ways I don't blame you.
No, I'm stuck in 1939.
All right.
That's a hell of a year. Yeah.
Yeah. And what are some of your favorite movies of all time, Sam?
Oh, well, I love all the big studio films. I love the classic, like Melda Pierce, you know, my idea of my favorite movie is when I start to watch it, I get sucked in and can't turn away. And Mildred Pierce is one of those.
Well, it's got this reputation as being a woman's film, but I think it's for everybody. It's a great crime thriller. It's got everything.
That is one of the few times Hollywood actually improved on the book, because James Cain novel never had any of the murder mystery in it at all.
Yeah, it's a great, great flick. And it's Warner Brothers at the top of their game, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
So is Joan Crawford one of your favorite movie stars?
She was, you know, she was considered washed up at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, MGM had just let her go like a year or two before, hadn't they?
That's right.
Oh my gosh.
And she won the Oscar for that.
She sure did. And, you know, actually, she made some of her best films at Warner Brothers after she left MGM.
So. Yeah. But I got to see her in person. She opened up a Pepsi-Cola plant in 1966 in Marion, Illinois, about a half hour from my hometown. So we went out there, and she was there signing autographs.
Well, she loved her fans.
Yeah. Mm. She stayed there. And, of course, they weren't charging for autographs back then, so it was great. So I've still got that autograph picture on my wall. So.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful.
Who else, Sam?
I also like the Day the Earth Stood Still. That's in my top three.
I just showed that last month at my 16mm double feature night. You should have attended.
That ages well, that film. Yeah. Doesn't it?
It holds up very well, yes.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of your favorite directors? Do you have some favorite directors?
Oh, I like a lot of Michael Curtiz's films at Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
And Robert Wise, of course. Mm-hmm. A lot of other good directors. Clarence Brown and people like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Wise could go from one genre to another just incredibly. He's got musicals on his resume, crime thrillers, you know, noir film classics, and India and science fiction. It's just terrific director.
Yep. And Marnie Nixon, who dubbed Natalie Wood's voice in Wise's West Side Story, just died like yesterday.
I've got a cute, quick story about Robert Wise. He attended this film festival I went to, and it was just full of movie geeks. You know, it wasn't one of these highfalutin ones like a Telluride or a place like that. And apparently his wife was misinformed of what kind of a convention it was, because she thought we were all crazy. She refused to come out of her room and mingle with any of us. Now, he was a great guy. He shook hands and pressed the flesh and made himself available, but she thought we were scum of the earth.
It's too bad.
Yeah. All right, well, let's call Michelle McCune. We're going to talk about top 10 over the weekend, top 12, as she calls it. And we got a bunch of movies to review. We're going to talk about the late Gary Marshall and some things going on locally, and then we're going to talk to Sam about his book. Let's give Michelle a call first, though. I got Michelle McHugh on the phone. Hello, Michelle.
Hi, everybody. How are you?
Oh, we're pretty good, thanks. Sam Maroney is here joining us today, filling in for you.
Hi, Sam.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Jim.
Good morning, Michelle.
How are you?
Great.
Good.
Okay, let's talk about the top 12 of the box office. I think Star Trek did pretty well, did it not?
This weekend. Here are the top 12 domestic weekend box office estimates as of Sunday, July 24th. Warping into the number one spot is Star Trek Beyond.
Warping, I get it.
Warping. Oh, you know, I'm a huge Trek fan. I had to get that in.
Yeah.
I'm just beaming over there.
May the force be with you. Okay, keep going.
The movie leads the global box office this weekend as it boldly earns $30 million in 37 international territories, put $59.6 million in North America for a total of $89.6 million.
Mm-hmm.
The two other entries opened, the two previous entries, opened in the $70 million range, so it'll have to do extremely well overseas. Earlier this week, Paramount announced a fourth film in the rebooted franchise. In the next installment of the Epic Space Adventure, Chris Pine's Captain Kirk will cross paths with a man he has never had a chance to meet, but whose legacy has haunted him since the day he was born. His father, played by Chris Hemsworth of Thor.
Oh, boy.
And Jim reviewed the film for us.
So Chris Hemsworth's in this new Star Trek.
Somehow they're going to have to do a time thing because his dad died at the beginning of the first film.
Okay. Yeah, obviously.
So, which I'm actually kind of looking forward to, which is kind of interesting since they've already announced the fourth film, but this film opened at $60 million. The other two have opened in the $70 million price range.
But they weren't up against Ghostbusters.
Yeah. So, moving on, one of 2016's biggest hit is number two, The Secret Life of Pets. That film brought in another $29.3 million, adding to its $260.7 million cumulative total here in the U.S. At number three is Lights Out from Warner Brothers Pictures. That did a surprising $21.6 million. The budget was probably all of $5 million, but it's doing incredibly well.
Good.
Coming in at number four is Ghostbusters with $21.6 million. Sony's film worldwide now has a total of $122.8 million.
Do you know what percentage of a drop that is? Is that like maybe about 30%, 40, something like
that? I think it's more than 50%.
Yeah. Oh, okay, dear. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, but no, it did. Oh, no, you're correct. It did drop off.
Yeah, they should have put men in that movie instead.
No, stop it.
It's like
stop
the women.
It. At number five is Ice Age Collision Course from 20th Century Fox. That film came in at $21 million.
That's not too good for a kid's movie.
No, well, look at your review. I mean, your review was dead on. Your review with it, they've kind of gotten lazier. But the budget, listen to this. Playing at 3,900 locations, the animated film has a reported budget of $105 million,
mm-hmm.
which is, for an animated film, that's Variety reported that, so that's kind of big. But, well, everybody's still going to see The Secret Life of Pets, or they're going to see Finding Dory, because that film came in at the number six spot with $7.2 million. And number seven is The Legend of Tarzan with $6.4 million. Warner Brothers' film global total is at a staggering $260
million. Hmm.
Pretty good. And number eight is Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates. That movie brought in an additional $4.4 million. And at number nine is a new entry from Senegal, he called Kabali with $4.1 million. So that's at the number nine spot.
Yeah, I wonder if that's playing anywhere near us. Interesting.
In the number 10 spot is Hillary's America, The Secret Life of from Quality Fix with $3.7 million. Very timely considering the Democratic National Convention that starts this evening. And
it's actually called, it's called Hillary's America, The Secret History of the Democrat Party.
Yeah. That film brought in $3.7 million. And
they didn't show that one to us. Surprise.
Oh, he didn't show us his last one there, Denise D'Souza.
Yeah. Did you see that one, Sam?
I did not.
Okay. All right, go on. I'm sorry.
Number 11 was Bryan Cranston's The Infiltrator with $3.3 million. So it's doing all right.
Yeah.
I'm sure they were hoping it would do better considering Bryan Cranston the lead in it, and it's a really good film.
Okay.
So rounding out the 12 is Central Intelligence with $2.9 million. New Line and Warner Brothers. So overall, Warner Brothers had a really great weekend at the box office. Plus, he also made a huge splash at Comic-Con this weekend with the first trailer for Kong, Skull Island, Wonder Woman, and Justice League. We got to see the first kind of teaser for Justice League, which Hall H went crazy. Also among limited releases is Fox Searchlight, absolutely fabulous movie. That debuted in 313 theaters. The big screen version of the cult series earned $1.9 million. Opening on the 29th of July is Bad Moms, Jason Bourne, Woody Allen's Cafe Society. That went from 5 theaters to 50 theaters this weekend,
mm-hmm.
earning $875,000. Also opening this weekend is Life Animated and Sony Picture Classics Eat That Question.
All right, good.
That is it for the box office.
All right, well, thanks for calling in. But we're going to let you hang out here on the phone with us for a few more minutes when we review movies, because
yes,
we are going to start our movie reviews with a movie that you have seen, correct? It is called Star Trek Beyond. Jim reviewed Star Trek Beyond at WeAreMovieGeeks.com.
I know why you're here, why we are all here.
Our captain will come for us. Mercy will be the last thing on his mind. I am counting on it.
Hey, would you give it 4?
Great review too.
Oh, well, thank you, Michelle. Yeah, I gave it 4 stars. I think it's a pretty solid entertainment. I think it's an improvement over Into Darkness, but that's not saying a whole lot. They're on a better track now, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. Everything from the way it was shot, Justin Lin did a great job with directing it. The pacing's great. Michael Giacchino provides another really great, thrilling, you know, and at times nostalgic Star Trek score.
Yeah, and I the script by Scotty, Simon Pegg, and Doug Young is really solid. Yeah, I was probably more entertained by the little exchanges, the verbal exchanges between the characters, than the big action set pieces. I think the strength of the Star Trek series is the affection that these characters have for each other, and that certainly was the case with the original crew, with Nimoy and Shatner, and this goes along with the new crew, with Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto and the new gang.
So you think it's better than the last one that had Benedict Cumberbatch?
Oh, I think it's miles above the best.
I like that one.
Yeah, it's this warp drive above the best one.
I did too, but this one, just there's such a human quality. You can tell Simon Pegg just kind of gave it that. Kind of has a lighter feel to it, a little more. There's a few tongue-in-cheek.
Sam has a question.
Paramount is desperate to keep this franchise going.
Oh, yeah, they need their tent poles, don't they? Then this is definitely one of them, right?
That is true.
Yeah.
So who's the villain in this new one?
It is Krall, played by Idris Elba. Oh. And he saw, someone was telling me the other day, oh, he's so handsome. I say, well, you're not going to be able to tell in most of this movie because he's got this heavy alien makeup.
Yeah, he looks like Bernie Casey in Gargoyles.
a little bit. But another strong.
I loved him as a villain too. I loved him as a villain.
Yeah. He is a great villain, and also strong in it is Sophia Boutella, who we last saw in the Kingsman film as Jayla. She's sort of a warrior princess that ends up helping the crew. I'm not spoiling too much with that, but yeah, she's a strong addition. And I tell you, Michelle, there's a scene about 10 minutes before the end of it. And I don't know how the audience reacted when you saw it, but boy, it's a sweet moment, man. And it's just
there's a lot of, if you're a Trek fan, bring some tissues, because.
And they bring out, doesn't Sulu come out of the closet in this one?
Well,
but it's very subtle. I like the way it was handled. If they were going to do that, which they did, and there was, George Takei kind of said, they should have created a whole new character for it. But the way it's handled is, it's very nice. It's not in your face. It's kind of, and it's just a normal family reunion type moment. So I really liked it. It was really well done.
Michelle, I was checking the credits, and I think his husband is this film's co-writer, Mr. Young.
Yes,
so.
It is.
Yeah, so that's interesting.
And over the weekend, Variety also had a great article about, can the franchise last, considering it's Paramount's biggest franchise. It needs to really do well overseas. But last week, before the film opened, they already announced a fourth film. So I don't think it has any. And I think it will have legs. Even with Jason Bourne opening, I think people will continue to see it. It's definitely a must to see in IMAX, because I saw it in IMAX. And we saw it Thursday night at 7 o'clock, and it looks really great in IMAX. It doesn't, even though Justin Lin, everybody was a little concerned about it's going to look like another Fast and Furious movie, but you know what? It doesn't. It's still Star Trek. Oh, and Star Trek also showed us over the weekend at Comic-Con the first trailer for the Netflix series, and they gave us the title, Star Trek Discovery.
Well, actually, Michelle, I hate to spoil it, but it's actually on CBS All Access streaming. Which is unfortunate.
Exactly. It's kind of like Netflix, I think, is carrying the overseas. But CBS, you're correct, Jim. CBS is the one distributing,
which makes me angry.
So I like the little teaser, and it looks good.
Yeah, they're sort of reversing the trend with the last Star Trek series with the original crew. It seemed like the even numbered films were the strong ones, and now with J.J. Abrams, it's the odd number of films that are the strongest, so it's kind of strange.
Good point, Jim. Good catch on that one. Yeah, because the old series, it was Trek 2, 4, 6 were the best, and now this...
Yeah. 1 and 3 are the best.
3 and,
But you mentioned Justin Lin. That was my only fault with the film. And if you're watching on the IMAX, the action scenes are so frenetically edited that you kind of get dizzy, after a while. Yeah. And that's why you're looking forward to those scenes where it's just them talking, you know.
You know, Michelle, we were talking about box office grosses. I wonder how much the merchandising plays into their decision to keep going with the franchise. It's got to be huge.
That's a really good point. Yeah, it's like, what will it do? They spent a ton of money with the marketing on this film, more than their usual budget. So between that, I mean, as far as marketing, as far as toys go, I don't know if you're going to see any of that. T-shirts, the like.
You'll probably see the gay Sulu doll.
No.
All right, well, Michelle, thanks a lot for calling in.
Are
you going to be able to call again next Monday?
I will.
All right, good. And get your top 10 of the 21st century list in. All right, we're gonna talk about that. We're gonna talk about that next Monday too, because that article's going up a week from tomorrow.
Sounds good.
All right, Michelle McHugh, everybody.
Thanks, Michelle, for the kind comments.
All right,
good work, Michelle.
We'll see ya. Bye. All right, we got a bunch more movies we got to review this morning. Jim, let's start off with a couple of documentaries that open at the Landmark Theaters this week. Frank Zappa. What's the full title of the Frank Zappa movie?
Eat That Question, Frank Zappa in His Own Words. And that pretty much sums it up.
Yeah, I have a wife, 4 kids, mortgage, the works.
I've never taken any acid. I've smoked about 10 joints over a period of 9 years.
Isn't it strange the fantasies that people have?
It's an assemblage of clips from most of the career of Frank Zappa. I think the earliest is a clip of him on the Steve Allen, I think it was Westinghouse, produced his nighttime show. Sam's nodding.
I watched it religiously.
Yes. And he was on there in this clip from 1960 demonstrating how to make music with bicycle spokes. Hmm. And they were having fun with that. But it's a lot of clips, a lot of pieces that were aired on television and in this country and abroad. And it mostly is about his career from the mid-60s when he formed the Mothers of Invention. There's a little bit about the movie that he made, 200 Motels. There's a little bit about the controversies that surrounded his career. There's footage from a concert, I think it was in Germany, in which people stormed the stage because Zappa wasn't going to make a statement protesting something that was going on there. Later on, Zappa himself is in some controversy because he goes up against the efforts to label and rate, put the ratings labels on records, and there's footage of him testifying at the sessions where Tipper Gore, I think, was spearheading right. that, as I recall. And then it goes to pretty much the end of his career. He has him traveling to Prague, where after their revolution, he's hailed as a genius, as sort of appointed as the head of the arts in Czechoslovakia. He's meeting with the head of the country. And then things start to slow down with him and about his fight with prostate cancer.
Yeah, a lot of concert footage?
A lot of concert footage. What's really fascinating to me is just watching him create. He was one of the first musicians to use a computer, and you see him mm-hmm. working on the early computer system, and there's footage of him writing out his music and working with orchestras. It's a really, if you're a fan mm-hmm. of Zappa's, it's a definite must-see, but even a casual person like myself, I think you'd get a lot mm-hmm. out of
and
it.
And you're reviewing this for WeardMovieGeek.com?
I will be reviewing it.
And how many stars are you going to
get? Probably going to be maybe 3.5, something like that.
All right, so. Very
now, despite his public persona, he was actually a pretty straight-laced guy, wasn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah. I showed that in the trailer,
He said, people think I'm drugs all the time. He said, I've smoked maybe 3 joints, he said, and this was like in 1970 he was saying mm-hmm. this. So, yeah, he was pretty much a teetotaler. He'd get aggravated if his band, he talks about that in the film. He's like, if you can't do your job, you're out, mm-hmm. So you gotta do that on your own time.
He was one of the few people I saw on Saturday Night Live who hosted that cracked up several times and mm-hmm. lost it during sketches.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't have that footage in it. I would love to have seen that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the other documentary you saw is called An Animated Life?
No, it's called actually Life Animated. It's based on the book of the same name by a fellow named Ron Suskind, who was a Wall Street Journal reporter, but it's not about big business. It's about his family life. He has 2 sons, Walt and Owen. He and his wife were stunned when at 3 years old, Owen was diagnosed with autism. Pretty much was silent. He was keeping to himself, and nothing could get him to communicate with them. He was sort of in his own shell. And the only time that he would seem to come alive would be when they were watching the classic Disney animated films, everything from Peter Pan to Pinocchio to The Lion King and things like that. And then finally, he started repeating phrases from those films. They found out that he could sort of relate to everyone and relate to life by the Disney animated films, and this was became a way for him to communicate with others. And the film is mostly about his 23rd year, Owen's 23rd year, where he's about to graduate from a school for special needs children. And he's about to move out on his own. He's going to move into a group home about an hour and a half from where his parents live. And it's all about that sort of transitioning and about how he's finally communicating with other people. And it's very hopeful. It's very optimistic. It's a very moving film. I think families dealing with this situation would get a lot out of it. Even someone that just has a casual interest in it, like I said, with Zappa, I think would find it fascinating.
Did they show clips from these Disney movies?
Oh, yes.
They?
Yes,
so
Disney.
They had the blessing of Disney, it sounds like.
Yes, yes, yes. Actually, and it has a lot of great new animation by a company called McGuff Animation. It's a little more sort of arty type of animation. It's mostly line work. They even animate a short story that Owen has written. One of the more interesting segments in it is his father talks about how Owen would disappear to the basement for hours at a time, and finally went down there and he found these tons of books filled with sketches of Disney characters, but they weren't the heroes of the animated films. Mm-hmm. They were all the sidekicks. They were all Iago the parrot, mm-hmm. Thumper, and all this stuff.
Yeah, they're more interesting anyway.
Yeah, yeah, and he writes a story where he's made himself the protector of the sidekicks because he doesn't consider himself a hero.
So you're reviewing Life Animated?
Yes. I'm going to give it a full 4 stars. Right. Well, if I would, I think Kate is going to be giving it 4 stars.
All right, but I know next we're going to move on because we've got a lot of movies to review. I know you absolutely loved Absolutely Fabulous, Jim. Is that right?
You're absolutely wrong.
Oh, what?
You don't know this, and I don't know this, but Kate Moss is changing her PR. You've got to get her.
No.
Kate Moss, darling.
I know. Kate reviewed that for us.
Yeah, I think she gave it 1 out of 5 stars.
I think she was being pretty even-handed. I might have gone 1.5 just because I have some affection for Joanna Lumley because she's a Bond girl, and she was...
She's in Wolf of Wall Street.
She's in Satanic Rites of Dracula.
Right.
So, we've got some affection for her for her genre work. But this is a film that's strictly for fans of the TV show.
I never saw. Did you see that show, Sam?
I never watched one minute of it.
Was that, so you saw it, and it's pretty lively. What's the whole deal with Kate Moss?
Well, that's the sort of big catalyst of the story. Edina, who's played by Jennifer Saunders, who created the show and has written the screenplay for this, she was part of the team French and Saunders. She's a down-on-her-luck PR person. The only people that she's representing are Baby Spice and Lulu. Mm-hmm. So she's desperate to get a new client, and she finds out that Kate Moss is needing new representation. So she goes to this fashion party where Kate Moss is, and of course she's outside the party, sitting on a ledge overlooking the Thames. Having a smoke, and Edina rushes over there and, of course, knocks her into the Thames, and she is lost. And that's one of the more clever bits in the film. It's all about this media frenzy about missing Kate Moss and whether she's died and all that. Mm-hmm. But and also the best part, and it's sitting next to or sort of standing next to Kate Moss through most of this before she's pushed off is St. Louis's own John Hamm.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a very funny bit in there where they pretty much say that John Hamm, as a 15-year-old, was deflowered by Joanna Lumley's character. And that's kind of amusing. But yeah, so you didn't see the film, you said, Tom?
No.
Okay, I saw the trailer for it.
It looked like Sex and the City to me. Of course, I never saw that either.
Yeah. Well, say this
it's
is
probably
this is,
towards. It's probably targeted at the same crowd.
Yeah. I was going to say it's kind of like the Entourage movie from a year or two ago. It's strictly for the fans, the uninitiated.
To use an old cliche, you will either love it or hate it.
Yeah, it's true. Well, that's
sounds
true.
Like Jim hated it.
Well, there are worse films out there. Mm-hmm. That's for certain. But just didn't do much for me there, and I was just counting off the time and counting off the cameos. Tons of cameos.
Yeah. Let's move on from a bad film to a good film, and that is Woody Allen's Cafe Society.
Hello? Come in. Sit. Christ, man, it's all about ego. This whole town runs on ego.
Yeah, I'm Bobby.
Bonnie, come in here, can you? Bonnie, this is my nephew, Bobby. Howard's a two-time Academy Award winner.
Wow, congratulations.
Hey, thank you. You've never heard of me. I'm a writer.
I'm the only one in the room who saw this. Are you a fan of Woody Allen there, Sam?
I am.
Good. I am, too. And Woody Allen
But you like his early funny films, right? That's the old standard phrase.
Well, those all came out when I was in college, so that was the thing to do. You went out to see Sleeper.
Oh, that's a prime time.
Everything you wanted to see about sex.
Bananas.
Well, Woody is now 80 years old, and he is still making great movies, as he has proven with Cafe Society. Jesse Eisenberg stars in Cafe Society as Bobby Dorfman, is a young fellow who lives in New York City and moves out to Los Angeles because his uncle, Phil, played by Steve Carell, is a talent agent for all the big stars out in Hollywood. This takes place in the mid-1930s. Uncle Phil gives Bobby a job as a sort of an errand boy in his organization, and he introduces him to his secretary, whose name is Vonnie, and she is played by Kristen Stewart. And Kristen Stewart takes Bobby out, takes him on tours of movie stars' homes and things like that, and shows him the ropes and shows him around Hollywood. And Bobby, sure enough, falls in love with Vonnie. But it turns out Vonnie is having an affair with Uncle Phil. It's really sort of interesting. If you watch the trailer for Cafe Society, you might think it's sort of an inside Hollywood thing. And there is a lot of name-dropping. But it's not like, what was the one, Hail Caesar, which came out earlier this year, which on the surface covers some of the same grounds, but it really doesn't. In Cafe Society, they talk about movie stars, and they mention movie stars by name. They go look at Joan Crawford's house, but nobody plays a movie star. The movie stars aren't characters in the film. It's sort of a tease. But I'm kind of glad, because Woody Allen, what he does is he really focuses on this love triangle. And then at about the 40-minute mark, the movie shifts gears and heads back to New York City, and that's where the rest of the movie takes place. The love triangle does not end where you expect it to.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about, Tom, because in the trailer they show a lot of his family back home, and I didn't know if that was intercut with this stuff in Hollywood, but it's like almost two films, huh?
Well, it just shifts locations. His mother is played by Jeannie Berlin. She plays Rose. You may remember Jeannie Berlin from the brilliant Heartbreak Kid, where she played Lila, but that was 45 years ago. She is hilarious. She gets actually the funniest lines in this film. But then again, this film is sort of a soft comedy. It's not really a hilarious film. It's really more of a love story. So he moves back to New York, and his brother, played by Corey Stoll, his brother Ben, is a gangster in New York, and he has bought this restaurant. So Bobby manages his brother's restaurant and becomes pretty successful. And that's in all the society of New York eats at this restaurant. That's why they call the movie Cafe Society. He meets Blake Lively, falls in love with her, they get married.
And I'm sure for a Woody Allen movie, there's lots of vintage music on the soundtrack.
Oh, yes.
It's a great-looking movie, too. Vittorio Strat, I can't think of the cinematographer's name, but he did Apocalypse Now. I mean, he's one of the top in the business. It's probably the best-looking movie that Woody Allen has made in a long time, and it's just a fantastic movie. It's funny. It's well-acted. I will say one thing. A couple weeks ago, we were in here, and I was saying, oh, we're going to go see this Woody Allen movie today, and I said it starred Jesse Eisenberg. I said, I wish someone else was playing this character. Did I not say that,
Jim? I think you did.
I did.
And I stand
corrected, because Jesse Eisenberg is fantastic in this film. He plays what we call the Woody Allen stand-in, or the Woody Allen surrogate, which is kind of a tricky role, I think. When it's done poorly, like Kenneth Branagh in
Celebrity.
Yeah. He was terrible. All he did was mimic Woody Allen. And I think John Cusack did not handle it very well in Bullets Over Broadway, and Jason Begg, what was that movie with
Christina Ricci? Yeah.
Well, it's done well. It's a great character. I think Larry David was brilliant in Whatever Works.
Yeah, and Owen Wilson was pretty good in Night in Paris, yeah.
Yeah, but Jesse Eisenberg, it starts out, I was kind of rolling my eyes a little bit at the very beginning, because he plays this, this neurotic Jew, just like Woody, and he sort of has these Woody Allen tics and mannerisms. I think, oh, he's just mimicking Woody. But to my surprise, as the movie progresses, and this character Bobby Dorfman becomes more confident and more successful and matures and grows, the Woody Allen sort of tics and mannerisms fall away, and he becomes kind of his own character. And it's really well done. I really have to credit Woody Allen, to tell you the truth. Nobody directs actors better than Woody Allen. Nobody has directed more Oscar-winning performances than Woody Allen, and it's really interesting the performance he gets from Jesse Eisenberg. And I had a bias against this actor. Yeah. Batman vs. Superman was not a good movie, but it would have been a better movie. It had a better villain.
That's true. A better written villain, that's for certain.
And, movies like American Ultra and things, his sort of, fussy, nerdy boy just I really bought him as an actor, but he's really good in this movie. So I stand corrected. Corey Stoll is really funny. He's a really nice guy. He doesn't quite understand what he's doing wrong.
Well, I've heard from some people that are turned off, they say, by Woody Allen's theme in a few of his films of the older man and the younger woman. And it sounds like that this is not the case with the film, that Jesse Eisenberg, is pretty much the same age as Kristen Stewart. And of course, you mentioned that Kristen Stewart's having an affair with Steve Carell, but that's not the focus of the story. Steve Carell is not the hero of the film.
No. Jesse Eisenberg. This isn't Jesse Eisenberg's first Woody. He was in From Rome with Love, but that was an ensemble piece. Yeah. Jesse Eisenberg, this is like Blue Jasmine. He's in every scene. This is all about him. Actually, I take that back. He's not in every scene. There is one sort of weird tangent subplot featuring Sari Lennick as his sister, Evelyn. And you may remember her from A Serious Man, the Coen Brothers film. She was Michael Stolberg's wife in that. Hmm. And she plays his sister, and she and her communist husband are living next door to this obnoxious guy that won't turn his radio down. So she approaches her gangster brother to have a talk with this guy. We don't want to know what happens to this guy. And then you've got this whole theme of, the guilt about murder that Woody has visited on a few occasions.
Oh, yes.
And it's brilliant. Cafe Society is one of the very, very best movies I've seen so far this year. Good for Woody Allen. All right. Let's move on. We're running out of time. Oh, my gosh. How about a quick review of Bad Moms?
You got 4 minutes to get Roscoe to the vet, so I love you, kids. Get out.
Emergency PTA meeting today at 5:00. Will we see you there?
I'll totally get a sitter on a Tuesday night.
Yes, you can. You actually can.
Okay, Bad Moms is going to open this Friday. It sort of is a cross between, or sort of extension. You start with Mean Girls, you go to Bridesmaids, and now you got the Bad Moms. And this is actually co-written and written and directed by two fellas. It's the fellas, John Lucas and Scott Moore, who were behind The Hangover. So you can thank them or blame them, depending on what you think of The Hangover films. But it's about two trios of women. One are the Bad Moms, who are headed by Mila Kunis, who is thought of as a bad mom because she can't do everything. Mm-hmm. And is just kind of shamed by the supposed good mom. So she ends up teaming up. She's head enough. She teams up with two friends, one Kiki, who is a beleaguered stay-at-home mom with like four little kids, played by Kristen Bell, who was just wonderful in everything. Forever Veronica Mars in my book. But the real standout, the breakout star of this film, is a terrific comic actress. We've loved her for a long time. But people will take note of Catherine Hahn after this film as Carla. And you've seen a bit of her in the trailer taking a selfie of herself while she's trying to work some cleavage, and she's fantastic as the ultimate bad mom who's really into going after the guys, kind of a man-eater, and she's hysterical in the film, and it comes alive whenever she's on screen. Mm-hmm. And she's been great in a lot of bad movies. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad to see her get a spotlight in this one. Now, the villains in it are the supposed good moms, the perfect moms, and they're headed by Gwendolyn, played by Christina Applegate, and she's sort of into the shaming the moms for not doing anything perfectly. She's head of the PTA, and she's got an assistant, a lackey, who's played by Jada Pinkett Smith, and then another lackey who's kind of dimwitted, who's played by Annie Mumolo, who is the co-writer of Bridesmaids. So there you go. And it's all about this. It's all about this struggle to raise their kids well and dealing with this. Mila Kunis' husband is a slacker, and that marriage is falling apart. Christina Applegate and Mila Kunis' character, Amy and Gwendolyn, are head-to-head going against each other to head up the PTA.
Is it funny? Let's cut to the chase.
Yes, I would say. Most of the time, it's funny, they rely a little too much on the party montages, which was a problem with Sisters last year. Yeah. Instead of showing funny stuff happening, they'd show just stuff in slow motion, brief clips, that sort of thing. Okay. But when the three ladies are together, Kristen Bell, Catherine Hahn, and Mila Kunis, when they're together getting ready to go out on the town or something like that, it's gold.
Okay, so are you reviewing Bad Moms?
I will be reviewing it. I think I'll probably give it 3.5.
Yeah. All right, so look for Jim's review of Bad Moms. Oh, Sam's got a question.
So two female ensemble comedy movies out now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if you count that, you count Absolutely Fabulous, there's three, we'll see how this one does.
Yeah.
But it is raunchy, though. Lots of F-bombs, so just be warned.
Okay, so a couple things going on locally. This weekend at the Tivoli at Midnight, The Goonies. Do you like The Goonies, Sam?
I saw it when it first came out, and I was underwhelmed.
Okay. Yeah, its popularity escapes me completely.
I think we're, addicted too old for The Goonies, because a lot of people tend 15, 20 years younger than us, love The Goonie. We've shown it at midnight at the Tivoli before, and it always gets a big crowd. So it has a huge following among
us. It's so politically incorrect now.
Yeah. It's true.
So that's The Goonies. Also at the Webster University this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 8 p.m., a double feature of Samuel Beckett's film, which Samuel Beckett's a famous playwright, but he made this film. It's only 22 minutes long. Have you ever seen that, Jim? Film?
No, I haven't.
Well,
no.
Stars Buster Keaton.
That's enough reason to see it.
And it was made in the 1950s. And apparently it's like a long chase scene. I don't know. I don't know much about it. I've never seen it. But when that's over, they're going to show The Cameraman, which is a 70-minute film starring Buster Keaton that was made, I think, it was one of his later films. I think it was made around 28.
That's one of the MGM films, right, that he did for them? Yeah.
And I've never seen The Cameraman. Have you seen it, Jim?
I've seen bits of it. I don't think I've seen the whole thing.
Are you a fan of Buster Keaton, Sam?
I am. I was just thinking about Keaton on the way here. I remember one of the old Beach Party movies. He appeared in those. And there was one scene where Rickles was in it, and he was in there. I guess they just let him go improv, but he was like destroying Annette and Frankie Avalon. And you can see Keaton in the background with that stone face, not even smiling at any of it. It was just surreal.
Oh, love Buster Keaton.
Yeah. All right, so that's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at Webster University. All right, let's talk to Sam now. Sam Maroney has joined us. Sam wrote this book, and it is called Tripping Through Pop Culture, The Misadventures of an Entertainment Writer. When did you write this book, Sam?
I wrote it about a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm. And what inspired you to write this book?
Well, it was the old cliche. I had this book in my gut. Mm-hmm. I'd been an entertainment writer for some 40-odd years, and I had collected all these memories and stories and photographs that I had shot of these celebrities over the years, and I kind of wanted to put it all together and put it in a memoir form.
Mm-hmm. Some great photos in there. I flipped through that earlier today.
Yeah,
boy, that's some fantastic stuff.
Excuse me.
You've been going to a lot of these movie conventions over the years, but you were going to these movie conventions back before it was cool. You were going back in the 70s and 80s, right?
Oh, one of the first ones I went to was in 72, right here in St. Louis, and it wasn't even about movies or comics. It was about pulp magazines.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Called PulpCon, and that got me started.
But did you go to – you were somewhere over this weekend, right?
I was at – I'm still going to PulpCon.
But that's not here anymore.
No, it's in Columbus, Ohio. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, Chicago has a pulp convention too, don't
they?
Windy City PulpCon? Is
that's
that what it's
correct.
Called?
Yes.
Yeah. So I like to go to that sometime. So.
Yeah. But we were going – movie convention, say, back in the days before it was like, you know, you had to go take a bank loan out to get in the door and buy autographs and things like that. Things were a lot more reasonable in those days.
Well, they would – again, in St. Louis, they had a couple Western film conventions there. And the B-Western is not my favorite genre, but they would disinter the – we kidded. We said they would disinter some of these people. They were so old and hadn't made a movie in 30 years. But it was just great because they mingled with people, did not charge for an autograph, and they genuinely seemed flattered and happy that someone remembered them.
Yeah. I remember one out at like a hotel by the airport, and this would have been the late 70s. And there was a room with a 16-millimeter projector, and they were showing old Westerns and film prints.
Man, I got to meet Victor Jory.
Oh.
William Whitney, the great B-movie director.
Yeah, he co-corrected the Captain Marvel serial, didn't he?
He did, yes.
Yes, yes, wow.
And I mean, he kept working right to the end. And people like Pat Buttram, and Mr. Haney himself, I mean, they were just walking around. You go up, and they sit down and talk to you. It was not like it is today.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got to see Clayton Moore in Chicago, and this was right after they took his mask away.
Yes.
And it was just wonderful. You could sit next to him and wouldn't charge anything for the autographs. It was just terrific back then.
It was amazing. Pulp magazines were published in the 19-teens to the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And they were like comic books, but only all words.
Mm-hmm. Well, the most famous pulp character is probably the Shadow, but the second most famous one is about to come to the big screen again, isn't
Doc Savage? Yes.
Yes, that's quite going to be quite.
And they influenced comic books, which of course the big thing in movies now.
You still go to movie conventions like the Ray Court shows and things like that up in Chicago.
Practically everybody I want to see is I either have met or gone.
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Yes, I haven't been to a convention in a while because the celebrities I've met or I don't care about. I care less about these Walking Dead people. But they get long lines.
That's true.
And now, you know, you can't approach them. You know, it's like the Gestapo.
Yeah. It's so controlled.
It is.
Can't even get your picture. You know, it used to be, a photo with a celebrity was sort of part of the deal. If you gave money for an autograph. you know, that would include a photo. Now photos are extra. Photos are like $50 extra.
Well, I remember when I saw Clayton, he had a stack of photos that you could buy there, yeah. And if you bought an 8x10 for $1, he'd sign it for you, yeah. You know, without a problem, and take a picture with you if you wanted. Mm. Now, you know, those days are long, long gone.
So you've interviewed a lot of celebrities then. So who are some of your favorite celebrities that you have interviewed over the years?
Oh, my favorites? Oh, I would say, I interviewed and kind of became friends with the actress Ann Rutherford, mm-hmm. who's in Gone with the Wind, one of Scarlett's sisters.
Andy Hardy films, too, right?
Didn't she just die a couple years ago?
She did. She lived a long life, and her husband was producer William Dozier.
Oh, my goodness.
Batman.
Yes. And he was the narrator of the Batman
show,
right.
too. That's right. An exaggerated narration.
Same bat time!
No, he had passed away by the time I seen her. I met her. And there's people I met, you know, Bob Hope and Vincent Price. And, you know, I was very bold in those days because, like, when people would come to Muni, you know, I would call them up at the hotel. And I should have had my head blasted off. But
that's okay.
Most of the older performers were very polite. And they said, well, I'll meet you in the lobby if you want some autographs. And I'd meet them there. Don Ameche could not have been nicer.
Really? I'd heard conflicting things about Don, but he was a pretty good guy.
They don't have celebrities at the Muni anymore. When was the last time they had somebody famous at the Muni?
They had Justin Glarini there, I think, this week.
I repeat, when's the last time they had somebody famous at the Muni?
And that was a big part of my celebrity encounters, besides, you know, being a professional writer, is back in the day in the 70s, there were a lot of dinner theaters.
Mm.
And they would get some stars there who maybe had lost their luster, and a lot of TV people. So I got to meet a lot of great character actors like Broderick Crawford and Don Porter, you know, who was...
How about Bob Crane? When you said dinner theater, I immediately thought of him.
I just watched that movie over the weekend.
Autofocus?
Yeah, I hadn't seen that movie.
He was killed while he was doing dinner theater, wasn't he?
I did not, but a friend of mine did. He was crazy about Hogan's Heroes, and he met him. He said he could not have been nicer.
Oh. Did you know the jacket that he wore in Hogan's Heroes is the same jacket that Sinatra wore in Von Ryan's Express?
No kidding. Yeah. I had no idea.
And it's the same jacket that Greg Kinnear wore in Autofocus.
There you go.
It was lent to him by Bob Crane's son. But I digress.
Yeah, when you mentioned dinner theater, that Bob Crane immediately popped into my head. So, definitely.
I had a lot more nerve than since then. Today I would not do that, but I would not be that bold. But I pursue it that hard, that bold. But
I guess
being young and...
So who were you writing for back in these days?
I was writing for a magazine primarily called Starlog.
Oh, I remember Starlog.
Oh, when it first started out.
The first issue had a Star Trek episode guide.
And it said, coming soon from George Lucas, The Adventures of Luke Starkiller. I remember that.
Well, that was the idea of Starlog. It was going to start to be a Star Trek fan magazine, but Paramount would not give them the license without them paying for it. So they just... converted it into a general movie magazine. And, you know, like so many publications, the internet killed it. But movie companies like Starlog, they never printed a discouraging word about any film.
They love everything.
As long as they gave them access and a lot of exclusive photos, things were hunky-dory, as they say.
Well, like I say, Starlog came on just at the right time because it was, you know, in the waning, or the mid-years of the Trek fandom, and then right before Star Wars came out. So they were right there poised to cover it and put it on the cover.
Everything went crazy then.
Yeah.
Before then, I'd been a science fiction fan all my life, and it was nothing to keep up with all the books and magazines that were out because there weren't that many. And after Starlog, now it's... I mean, you go to the bookstore now, you couldn't even begin.
Yeah. Back then, it was just Forry Ackerman with the famous monsters. Yeah.
That's right.
You were in one of the Planet of the Apes movies. Was that from Starlog? Does that your gig at Starlog get you in that part?
Well, it did. Actually, that gig preceded Starlog, writing for Starlog, because I was writing for one of the local newspapers. But I had curried favor with some of the publicists at 20th Century Fox, and they did the hoary old publicity stunt of having somebody come in and be an extra for a day.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So, you know, it was very, very exciting to watch Roddy McDowell and Paul Williams get made up and just watch the whole mechanics of filming. The day they had me out there, they did not have a call for ape extras, so I was a human mutant. And they, you know, put me in the makeup chair and put this big bubbling scar on my face. In fact, I had them take it off very carefully at the end of the day. I still have it.
You have the appliance?
I have the appliance,
You didn't get to speak with Roddy, did you? He always struck me as a really nice guy.
Yeah,
he did speak
with
him.
I did. Because, you know, the unit publicist there, he took me around, introduced me to all the actors, and talked to him and Paul Williams, and that strange man called Severin Darden.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
oh,
yes.
Yeah, I know who he is.
I
had spoken to him, and he was on the set. I wanted to ask him one more question. He looked at me and said, "Now what do you want?"
Did you rest a little bit? Did you see that documentary from a couple of years ago about Paul Williams? They covered a little bit of that movie.
Yes, they did.
Was a very interesting documentary. If anyone gets a chance to see it, yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
and I got to also talk to J. Lee Thompson, the great action director,
Guns and Navarone, right?
Yes.
Oh, he directed 9 Charles Bronson movies.
He did. Oh, yeah. You should know that.
Yeah. So what else? Who else have you met over the years that you want to talk about?
Well, I just met a lot of the great B players. I never really met any top door stars, but
well, the B players I think are probably more
absolutely
interesting.
Yeah,
interviews
really.
Probably aren't as canned as some of the big stars.
Yeah, no. I was here when they filmed Escape from New York.
Oh,
there we
yes.
Go.
And I thought I'd long passed being awed by stars, but when they had a local press conference here, and here comes Ernest Borgnine, here comes Donald Pleasence, here comes Lee Van Cleef, comes Isaac Hayes, I'm just like Kurt Russell,
Adrian Barbeau.
Yes, it was just overwhelming.
Yeah, we were talking a couple weeks ago about losing Noel Neal. Did you ever get to meet her or any of the other Superman cast?
I did. She was one of the first people to come to conventions and sell her autograph.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Sell pictures. And she and Kirk Allen would do that constantly.
It got
to a point where people said, oh, we're sick of both of them. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, there's a couple of guys that go to Wizard World here in town every year, and I was like, oh, they're coming back. But yeah, I know what you mean. But I got to meet Kirk. I've got his autograph. He was a fantastic guy. Yeah.
I would always be liked by these older stars because I would ask Kirk Allen more about just playing Superman. I'd ask him about some of his other B movies, and Noel Neal had a great career in B films, and we would talk about that. And I would always pull out pictures from my collection and bring them with me. And if I had duplicates, I'd give them as a gift. And, of course, I was in like Flynn then.
Yeah, I've always heard that, you know, if you do happen to meet a star, you know, don't ask for an autograph or a photo. But, you know, if you want to talk about their work, go with something that's kind of obscure and they'll really dig it. A friend of mine had worked with Leslie Nielsen, and everyone was wanting to go up and talk to him about Naked Gun. And he went up to him and said, I'm the biggest Forbidden Planet fan. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, yeah, I love that. And then they talked for a while about that. So they love that.
The saddest thing I encountered talking to these stars is very few of them kept any memorabilia from their past.
It is kind of unusual. Maybe they just thought it wouldn't have any value.
That's right. They never thought of it. They were just busy going on to the next movie. And a couple of them doubted my sanity that I would even ask a question. Like, what would I want that for?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, happily, a lot of them gave their stuff to Bob Burns, and he's been showing those off. Yeah.
So who's the nastiest star? Come on, dish it out, Sam.
Okay, I don't mention her by name in my book, but I'm going to mention her name on the air.
Hints.
Jeanette Dubois, who was in Good Times.
Okay.
She was not nice to me.
Oh, okay. Goodness. And she was the eldest daughter on Good Times, right? Okay, yeah.
Who is she to be rude to a fan, seriously?
Well, she was rude to me as a professional because I was interviewing her legitimately for a local paper. And, you know, she was at some benefit, and I walked in there, and she was giving somebody at the benefit holy hell and pointing her finger in his face, and I thought, this isn't going to go well.
Mm-hmm. So how's your book been received so far, Sam?
It's done real well. I've got, when I put this together, I called in every favor. The cover was done by the great artist Joe Phillips, who is at Comic-Con right now, and he's done all kinds of great comic book work and commercial illustration. And then I called in all my chips and got people like director Kevin Wilmot to write a blurb, and Joe Sinnott, the artist who's one of the architects of the Marvel Universe.
The best inker on Jack Kirby,
absolutely,
I say.
Yes. Absolutely. So,
so you think you'll write a follow-up maybe someday?
I am.
Okay, good.
I am. It's coming soon.
All right. Well, terrific. Did you ever meet Gary Marshall?
I did not.
Did not. All right. Well, Gary Marshall died last week. Unfortunately, Jim wrote a terrific obit for a great producer, actor, and director, Gary Marshall. I feel a little bad because I trashed his last movie a couple months ago. It's called Mother's Day.
It's deserving.
Yeah. I don't know if he was a great artist as a director, but boy, oh boy, he had a long career. He certainly discovered a lot of people and made a lot of careers for people. Jim, why don't you talk a little bit more about Gary Marshall.
Well, Gary Marshall, when he was profiled by most of the media outlets, it was singling in or focusing in on his career in television, which is very considerable. He was a writer for a long time for different comedians in their variety shows, and then he sort of broke through as the producer who helped adapt the hit movie and play The Odd Couple to television, and that's established him as sort of a TV superstar. That led to Happy Days, and I think I mentioned in my obit that he almost owned Tuesday Nights on ABC because we had the spinoff from Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, and then a spinoff from Happy Days named Mork and Mindy, and another spinoff called Johnny Loves Chachi. Actually, he didn't start making movies until fairly late. 1982 was his first film. The first of 18 was Young Doctors in Love. I think I mentioned it's sort of an airplane-like parody.
Sean Young,
I
think, was in there.
Sean Young, Michael McKean, and I think Patrick McNee is in it, as I recall. And then he got a little more autobiographical with The Flamingo Kid, and he did a few other films, and then, boy, did he hit pay dirt with Pretty Woman in 1990. Yeah. That was a huge hit. He still dabbled in television. He still would work in, you know, directing and producing and writing things. As was said, his last film was just three, four months ago.
Yeah.
But
Mother's Day, and then he did, I guess, Valentine's Day and New Year's Day and Arbor Day.
Oh, those are dreadful. You know, we don't remember him for those films. No. But I don't know. I have a favorite.
I don't blame him. Those seem like movies by committee. He was just a director for hire, I suspect.
Well, I actually worked on the script to Mother's Day. One of the interesting things I saw, supposedly, he is in Goldfinger as a gangster. I've got to get my Blu-ray out and see if I can spot him in that, an uncredited cameo.
So we got to wrap this up. Jim, what's your favorite Gary Marshall movie?
I'm going to go with Nothing in Common because of Jackie Gleason.
And Sam, do you have a favorite Gary Marshall movie?
I would say the same, Nothing in Common.
Okay. And I would say The Flamingo Kid. A terrific Matt Dillon performance in there. That's one to dig up. But we've got to wrap it up for now. Sam Maroney, thanks a lot for joining us this morning. And
thank you for asking.
I hope everybody picks up your book, Tripping Through Pop Culture.
Available on Amazon.
All right. And next week, we'll be back to review Nerve and this new Jason Bourne movie. But for now, I'm Tom Stockman.
Jim Betts.
And Sam Maroney.
And listen again next week.
Black leather, black leather, hip, hip, hip. I got that feeling, black leather rock. Black leather, black leather, smash, smash, smash. Black leather, crash, crash, crash. Black leather, kill, kill, kill. I got that feeling, black leather rock. Black leather, crash, crash, crash. Black leather, kill, kill, kill. I got that feeling, black leather rock.
Forward into battle, there, chaps.
You happy in your work, Joni?